So I'm like, screw the bivy, man. I'm going to crawl in Brad's tent. I was like, I'll apologize or ask for permission tomorrow. Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff and no BS. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 85. This episode, at least the first half of it, is going to be a recap of the Exo Mountain Gear death hike that we went on a couple weeks ago. Hopefully you guys caught the episode that Steve and I talked about the hike beforehand, kind of explained the history and things like that for further context. If you haven't caught that one, go back and check out the episode titled Practice Suffering. So the death hike was a first for me. I've done plenty of adventures, plenty of events that have some similarities, but certainly hadn't done the death hike, as Exo puts it, together. Had an absolute blast, definitely tested myself in many ways, and of course, I'm here, I'd love to tell about it. In the end, we ended up covering just under 40 miles. Me and a few guys went straight through, which you'll hear about, and did it in about 17 hours. Amazing, amazing, beautiful country, looking over into Hell's Canyon, getting some amazing peaks and passes in Idaho. Absolutely had a blast. So we'll talk a bit about gear, about experiences that we had on the death hike coming up in the show. One thing that was definitely a standout for me on this hike was the Arrowool top from First Light. You guys have heard us talk about First Light before. You know that they're a sponsor of the show. Thank you to them for doing that. But well before they were sponsoring this show, we've been using First Light. But really on this death hike, it was absolutely ideal for what we were doing. Kept me cool, kept me pretty dry, definitely drier than your standard merino. So Arrowool is a blend of merino wool, I think 65%, as well as 35% of First Light's 37.5 technology, which you can go read all about. It's legit. If you guys are hunting warm weather, upcoming antelope hunts, early deer, early elk, things like that, definitely consider checking out First Light's Arrowool. So the guest on this episode is a friend of Steve's, Tyler Boschma. He was with us on the death hike, so we thought with the three of us, myself, Steve, and Tyler, it would be great to recap things. After we talk about the death hike a bit, we also go into some of Tyler's hunting history and upcoming hunts. He has some great stories to share with you guys, so I hope you enjoy it. Before we get going, want to send a shout out to Logan for sending us some questions and feedback. We're going to send him some Exo Mountain Gear swag. Listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, it's really simple. We just want to hear from you. If we can get a review from you on iTunes, that would be fantastic. If you want to reach out to us directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com with any questions, comments, or feedback, that would be great. We'd love to answer your questions. If you guys have questions about the death hike, things that we didn't cover, go ahead and shoot us an email. We'll definitely get back to you on that. All right. Finally, want to let you know, going to double up this week. We're releasing this episode, and then we're releasing an awesome episode that we did with Joe Jax from Tight Spot Quivers. Some really timely stuff about hunting antelope. It's going to be awesome. Make sure you guys are subscribed. Go to exomountaingear.com/podcast. Subscribe, and don't miss the future episodes, such as one later this week with Joe Jax. Okay. Let's get into this episode covering the death hike, covering some hunting stories with our guest, Tyler Boschma. Tyler, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Good, man. Excited to have you. Excited to have you on board. You know, one of the things that we wanted to cover in this episode is kind of wrapping up the death hike that you and Steve and I were on, three of us on the call, three of us on the death hike. It'd be a good time to wrap it up. We received questions on social media and emails. In fact, literally just got one within the past hour. Logan from Virginia wanting to know how everything went with gear and stories and all that from the death hike. So we'll get there. But First, Tyler, for our listeners and for some context, would love just to kind of get an introduction from you, kind of some background, anything you want to share, whether that's hunting history or personal stuff, you know, love to hear about it.
Yeah, so I'll just give it the, you know, at 30,000 feet or whatever, kind of skim over the top here. I grew up in southern Idaho. Just started waterfowl hunting there in southern Idaho and kind of just wanted to get out. Didn't have really that many family members that hunted. And a bunch of us buddies would just get out and kind of early age got exposed to, you know, learning it on our own. And I got into archery hunting and a few of us started trying that whole deal when we were, 17 or so. And I didn't end up killing my first archery animal until I was 19. And that was the year I left to the Air Force. And then from there, I did about a year of training, didn't really get a hunt. And then the next year I was in Alaska. So I went from, you know, trying to learn the ropes to kind of being thrown into it and awesome country to really, you know, expose yourself to some good archery hunting. And in Alaska, I just hunted my brains out as much as I could. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, kill a couple moose and some caribou and just get exposed to that whole area up there and really learn what it meant to be, as a bow hunter. I got my sheep while I was up there. That's kind of one of my big bucket list items that I really wanted. And that was actually my last hunting season there. After that, I moved to New Mexico and armed with a bunch of knowledge and kind of, you know, was exposed to some backcountry stuff in Alaska. I went to New Mexico a little bit more prepared and I kind of figured out some good areas to elk hunt. And up until then, I actually had never elk hunted before. I mean, really, in Idaho, I kind of walked around with a bow and blew on a hoochie mama, you know, nothing.
Give it the old squeeze.
Walking, you know, crazy wind, walking right into elk and stuff. And just, so I really don't know if I count that as elk hunting. But yeah, you know, going to New Mexico, I was a little bit more prepared this time. I missed my first hunt season there. I was deployed. And then after that, I kind of was about every other hunting season. I was there to hunt. I just did the backcountry thing. And almost two of the three elk I killed while I was down there were all almost 7 miles away from any kind of trailhead. So, I mean, they were definitely long hauls. And then after that, I got out. I moved up here to Oregon, where I work for the Army Corps now. Also while I was down in New Mexico, can't forget this part. I met my awesome wife.
Can't leave that out, man.
Yeah. Drug her out of New Mexico, and now we live in Oregon. We just had our first baby, little Dylan. So this will be my first year with a kid and trying to hunt and, you know, juggle all that stuff amongst build a house. So, yeah, it's been pretty exciting the last couple of years.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned, you were in the service for a good portion of that time, especially those years in Alaska and everything else. Were you hunting solo? Were you hunting with locals? Were you hunting with other guys from the forces? How did that play out?
It was kind of 50-50. I had buddies, you know, in the Air Force too that they wanted to hunt. I think at the time for me, it was kind of a transition time where I was, you know, learning how to backcountry hunt and just, I really didn't have many friends that wanted to, you know, they didn't want to hunt like that and they wanted to come back to the truck every night. And I wanted to get out there and get where the sheep were or you know, what have you. So I just ended up hunting probably about 50% of the time by myself.
Yeah. Any stories that stick out from like those early days? Because that's heck of a way to cut your teeth on backcountry hunting is to do it in Alaska. Like, and you just like flat out like rookie moves that come to mind or funny stories.
Oh, I mean, I'm pretty meticulous as far as trying to be prepared when I get into stuff like that, but I definitely had just a ton of little things. I mean, one of the things, and I don't know why I keep talking about this so much, but maybe it's because I'm going back to Kodiak this year, but my first trip to Kodiak, Actually had a Coast Guard mission scrambled for my buddy and I. Long story short, we were there a couple days past our pickup point. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think 4, maybe 5. But anyway, long story short, we had good weather on our side, and we thought, you know, what the heck, why aren't we getting picked up? And I had one of those spot devices, and on there you have the okay message, which I'd been sending every day. And then you have the help message, which I had told everyone on that message, you know, if you see this message or whatever, make sure you call my pilot and have him come pick us up because we're ready to get out. And then, of course, you have the SOS button. Well, we hit that help button, hoping that they would at least call the pilot and, you know, maybe get something figured out if he had some kind of delay that, you know, he'd come get us because we're, you know, pretty well out of food and whatnot. So anyway, I pushed that help button, and I had, I think it was 4 people on that message. Most of them were, you know, Air Force, you know, military types, and they ended up getting my command involved and officers and stuff, and the decisions were made to, you know, call the Coast Guard and have them come check on us. So luckily the Coast Guard called our pilot before he or before they really, you know, got into our neck of the woods. So they ended up just hovering over, you know, making sure we're alive, and he came down, picked us up, and he's like, what the heck? But yeah, so lesson learned on that. Make sure I have a good communication plan back home. So now I use one of those DeLorme inReaches.
Yeah, a bit more versatile for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
When you can.
So what was the story on your pilot not being able to come pick you up?
Well, we had the bad weather on our side, which I guess put him behind, and then he had some bad weather on his end, and it was like kind of a domino thing, and yeah, it just worked out where he was a little bit late.
That's funny. We'll definitely get back to talking about some Kodiak and some other stuff that you have upcoming, but let's transition to the death hike. Gotten quite a few messages since that's been completed, and we definitely want to give some podcast time to that and kind of debrief and talk about the after the fact show, since we've covered a bit beforehand. So just thinking of, you know, gear choices, whether that be clothing, footwear, otherwise, and nutrition, training, you know, we'll kind of get into all that, at least for each of us individually, in terms of things that stick out. But Steve, kick us off with a summary of, you know, how you perceived the death hike this year.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, like, you know, I got asked right when we got out, and I was like, man, like, very fortunately, but at the same time, unfortunately, we don't have some great epic story from it this year. You know, like, everything just kind of went good. You know, nobody got sick, no rattlesnakes. The trails were in good condition for pretty much the whole thing. So, you know, I was kind of frankly a little disappointed at the end of it. I mean, granted, 38 miles isn't ever easy to do, but it was definitely about half as hard as it was for us last year. So the only mistake I made this year is I kind of got, you know, it was plenty hot, and I got to that point where I just like didn't want to eat. I was having to force myself to drink, and I just didn't take very good care of my nutrition, where I was definitely like not feeling very good by the end of day one. And this is all just my own fault for just not taking care of my body. So I think next year, lesson learned is, somebody had mentioned on the hike, and I can't remember who it was, but, you know, just like set an alarm on your phone or your watch or something like that to go off every, you know, 30 minutes to make sure that you just eat a little something, or every hour or whatever. Cause it was definitely something where I just got hot and just couldn't eat. I didn't eat like a third of the food I brought on that trip.
Well, part of that was cause you brought like 8 pounds for other guys too, being like the backup guy for people like me who are worried that I didn't have enough calories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. On the food front, I kind of caught some flack because I posted before the hike what I was taking, and guys were ridiculing me and questioning my sanity on how many calories I had. And, go ahead.
I think that kind of stems from last year. We all tried to take that minimalist approach on food, and that bit us big time.
Yeah. Well, I was just getting ready to say, like, it was the right amount for how well things went, but I could see that, you know, if it would have gotten drug out further or ran into major issues or extended things, then, you know, some more calories could have been used. But like, yeah. I ended up throwing some stuff in last minute. But then I ended up with about that much food left over. So, you know, it was definitely like a best case scenario, deal in terms of how I packed. But in general, you know, I was kind of going for having 100 calories per mile, you know, figuring we're going to be 40 miles-ish, and I had a bit over 4,000 calories before I threw the extra in, which is about, you know, it's about what I went through. But again, if it that was kind of best-case scenario, unfortunately, we had good weather and good trails and somewhat of a best-case scenario, so yeah. It worked out in this case, but yeah, it definitely wasn't yeah. padded with extra reserves if things got super nasty, that's for sure.
Yeah, I just, like I said, Tyler and I came from the year prior where I think like that last few miles I had like one little Trader Joe's instant coffee packet, and he, Brad, and I like poured that in this thing, and that was like, I think that literally saved our ass, you know, like just a little bit of sugar and whatever that was, and that was it. That was all the food we had left. So it was definitely worth, you know what, I'll throw 2 pounds in extra this year to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Yeah. What sticks out for you in general, Tyler, when you think about this year's death hike?
Yeah, same kind of theme. I was not too disappointed, but I mean, just a little that it wasn't as, because I felt like we let everyone on that this is, you know, this is so crazy. And then it turned out to be super mellow. But other than that, gear wise, for me, I think it was my bivy sack. I was hoping to have that new Enlightened Equipment Recon bivy. I think it's pretty close to the one Steve runs. And I didn't have that. I still had my old military bivy. And I learned from last year, that thing, anytime there's bugs around, I can't be in it because it doesn't completely seal off. And so all night I stayed up kind of, you know, fighting the bugs, wishing I'd continued on with you guys.
Yeah, it's funny. Just to give, I guess, the story on that we ended up in separate groups this year a bit. And part of that was forced in the beginning. We intentionally started off in three groups just because moving through a wilderness area and restrictions on group size there. I guess we reached the halfway point where we were planning on camping at the end of day one. And the front group got there quicker than we anticipated, had a ton of daylight left. It was a great place to freaking camp, but at the same time, guys were somewhat a bit anxious, I think, about just sitting there so long. So made the decision to go ahead and push through and just complete the hike straight through without staying overnight. So that was kind of the goal. And then, you know, a little over half of us left with that and then ended up splitting further from there because some of the guys that left decided, again, once we hit another camp spot and came through probably, you know, the worst section of trail for a few miles, it probably took some out of some guys to camp through. But anyway, long story short, some of us ended up hiking straight through. I was one of those, but it was funny just thinking of bivy, as you mentioned, Tyler, because like the last 3-4 miles of the hike, you know, it's, I don't even know what time, like 1 a.m. or something like that. And we're bombing back down, knowing that, you know, for us that went straight through, we're going back to kind of the base camp we had set up the night before. And I'm thinking, all right, man, you know, we're going to get back and I got my bivy and I'll set up my bivy. And then we were all talking like, yeah, the coolers are back there. We'll drink a cold beer, blah, 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 blah. And then I had this revelation, like when we were 3 miles from finishing the whole hike, I was like, wait a second, back at that base camp, I know that Brad had a nice tent set up. So I'm like, screw the bivy, man. I'm going to crawl in Brad's tent. I was like, I'll apologize or ask for permission tomorrow, which is totally what I did. So I had to skip the bivy. But not only that, when we got back to camp at like 2:30 in the morning, I zip open Brad's tent and take a peek inside. Instead of using my backpacking air mattress I was planning on, he had like this massive car camping air mattress that had like memory foam in it and all kinds of stuff like that. So yeah, needless to say, I was pretty stoked to do that versus bivvying out. But it was also funny because we got back to camp at 2:30 in the morning and we were all so tired that none of us celebrated nor drank a beer. We just kind of went our separate ways and crashed.
Yeah, which, I mean, you guys did 38.8 miles in 17 hours just straight through.
Yeah, 17.
Yeah, I mean, that's Not many guys are going to do that. That's pretty impressive.
Well, I had to make it, you know, you guys were saying it was easy, so I had to get the full experience for my first one.
Yeah. No, that was awesome.
Yeah.
And Tyler over here is a walking billboard for Solomon. The guy pulled a brand new pair out of the box. That up.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I literally... Yeah. Yeah, totally just, I pulled up to the truck because I ordered the Solomon 4Ds, and they took a while to come in. But yeah, the day we left to drive out there, they showed up. So, I mean, I was pulling them out of the box and went on a 40-mile hike to break them in.
What? I mean, obviously, you got a base there of confidence in Solomon that's not just going to destroy your feet.
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of been lucky with the feet stuff. I kind of, even in the military, breaking in boots there, we have some pretty terrible boots, and you know, I was fortunate in that department. I don't know. I just that, and those are great boots. So
yeah.
Worked out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's.
I would not advise that for anybody else.
Right.
Don't fresh go on a Western box. Hunt with boots fresh out of the box.
Yeah.
I mean, I was nervous. I remember looking at Nick and I was like, dude, how dumb am I?
Have you worn 4Ds specifically before, I assume?
Yeah, I had them, gosh, a while back ago. Then I went away from them and I tried those Discovery, I think they're called GTX. I don't think they make them anymore. But my feet have grown. So I had to get a new pair of boots. Like it was, my feet are either going to be cramped in these older broken boots, and or I'm going to buy a new pair of boots and they're going to be the right size. And this just happened over like the last 6 months, and I really noticed it on, we did a kind of a test hike for the death hike. We did a 24 miler a couple of weeks before that, and that's when I really noticed. I lost a toenail and stuff, and I was like, okay, it's time to go up half a size. And so yeah, long story short, that's how I ended up ordering a pair of boots so last minute.
Yeah. So speaking of, you mentioned the test hike, just wanted to touch on any specific training that, you know, either of the three of us did for it, really. I mean, I'm, I guess, the lone flatlander. For me, it was just, you know, I had a decent base from doing some other events this spring, like the GoRec, which I mentioned, and things like that. And I've been hiking with some weight and, you know, just doing step-ups for me, like loaded step-ups with a loaded pack onto a box, which are mind-numbingly boring but incredibly effective training, I think. So really, I mean, that was like the extent of a specific training that I did for the hike. I mean, I kind of train 5 days in general, but, you know, the loaded step-ups and just hiking with weight is the extent of the specific training I did for the death hike. Did either of you guys do anything specific ramping up into this, or just kind of program as usual?
Steve?
Yeah, we do our weekly hikes, which we haven't been as consistent, where we do every Tuesday and Thursday. And we basically start that in January. So we're pretty consistently out there hiking. And then, you know, this year with the baby, I'm not as in good shape as years past, but still getting out there on my bike. And you know, to me, if I'm biking a lot, then I can hike really well. And then anything specific right before the death hike, I kind of did just mixed it up a bunch. Went for some more runs than I usually do. Typically, I don't run a lot, just hard on my lower back. And just kind of worked a few different muscles, just kind of make sure I was hitting everything where I wasn't going to get sore during the hike. But that was pretty much it. You know, it's kind of pretty much our life out here is hiking and moving. So I didn't have anything too super specific.
For me, I felt more unprepared this year than any other year. Same thing with Steve, new baby and house and everything. I'd get in a couple hikes here and there and kind of lift through the winter. We got our own little gym in our house and stuff. And but other than that, yeah, I've not been consistent.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you guys kudos, both having babies within the past year, because when my wife had our first, I gained as much weight as she did when she was pregnant, but I just didn't have the good fortune of having a baby to get rid of the weight. So she went back to normal and I was like, oh God, I'm just fat. So you guys came through pretty clean, I would say, for being through a pregnancy in the first year of having a kid. So kudos on that.
Yeah.
Any other, I know we mentioned the footwear, mentioned nutrition, any other gear that stands out, in terms of what worked well, what didn't work well, what do you wish you would have brought that you didn't, or what did you bring that you totally shouldn't have? I mean, I think the three of us had this fairly dialed, so there's probably not a ton here, but does anything stand out?
Not really.
Yeah. It's funny. The one thing for me, that was like, oh man, I'm so glad I had that, was as we were driving up from Boise, Steve's like, hey man, I have some of my daughter's baby blanket here if you want to cut a piece off to give you some shade for your neck and your ears. And that was literally the one thing I kept thinking through the hike is, I'm so glad that Steve had me cut off a piece of baby blanket, because dipping that in the stream, having that under my hat to cover my neck and my ears with as hot as it was and as much sun exposure as there was a freaking lifesaver.
Yeah, it's so counterintuitive to like, I didn't do it the whole time, but to hike with pants and long sleeves and like even Brian Barney, I mean, long sleeves and a sweater and had a hood on the whole time, you know? Yeah. And it seems so backwards to do that because it's going to get hot and sweat more, but keeping that sun off you is way more important. Because that the fatigue from that sun and getting sunburned, that takes a toll.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the only other thing that I think stands out for me was being much more intentional than I have in the past about electrolytes. I think we mentioned in the episode before about the death hike, Steve, you mentioned how salt capsules in your previous were a lifesaver, I think Brad had. I didn't pop many of those, but I was really consistent with taking electrolyte tablets in my water, like the Nun or Noon tabs, however you say that. Mine were actually from Goo, that brand. But just those little tabs that dissolve, A, they give your water some flavor, which is kind of nice to mix it up. But just staying on top of that really consistent, I think was absolutely critical to keep me from cramping up or having any issues. I'm really prone to cramping, especially after doing a big effort like that. And so I was all but certain that after hiking like 40 miles in 17 hours, I was just going to hit the tent and just wake up with really bad cramps, because it's happened countless times to me before. But I absolutely had zero issues. And I think a big part of that was staying on top of the electrolytes.
Yeah, it's all new territory to me on something like that for that long of an endurance. But it'd be great to get a guy who runs like a, you know, 100 mile or something like that and see what they're doing for their nutrition. Just to kind of, you know, it's all when we're hunting, I mean, it just puts hunting's easy, right? I mean, it's compared to what we're doing on this. You just don't have to be as on top of your game to making sure you're staying hydrated and getting the nutrients that you need.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's a kind of a wrap up on the death hike. If you listeners out there have any questions, I mean, as always, we're an open book to share anything, any specifics, just shoot us an email to podcast@xmongear.com. We'll get you straightened out or kind of give us our opinion on anything.
Yeah.
Tyler,
all I can say is next year is going to be a hell of a lot harder.
Yes.
Oh, the pendulum is swinging back.
It wasn't easy, and all the guys that were new to it this year were like, oh man, I can't imagine doing much more, but you know, Tyler and I've been on a true death hike, and I got to get back to it for 2018.
Well, I did tell you it was a one and done for me, right?
Yeah.
No, it was cool. Like some of the ideas that we talked about even on the way back of mixing in some other aspects, like, you know, doing a hike into a pack rafting trip, or, you know, mixing in a float, you know, with pack rafting gear, something like that would be really cool to see where it goes.
Yeah,
for sure. Just an adventure.
Yeah. That'd be a blast.
Yeah. Cool. Tyler, let's dive into some of your stuff, man. So I know that you kind of mentioned Kodiak. You're heading back this year up to Alaska. Is this the first time that you're headed back since you've kind of been stationed up there for a hunt?
Yeah, this will be my first time going back as a non-resident. So both the times before I hunted Kodiak, I did it in November, and this time we're doing it in August. So that's also kind of new territory there too.
Yeah. So what's the difference there? Because I know November's rut, right? So what are you expecting to be the difference. We've talked briefly about this, I think, with Eric from Muley Freak, right, Steve? He was going up to Kodiak and kind of talked about hunting that during the rut.
I think he did more down the POW, like Southeast Alaska stuff.
Oh, did he? Okay. I was thinking that was Kodiak.
Same kind of country that's a little bit, I think, steeper and whatnot down there in that part of the Alaska. But yeah, Kodiak, same thing in August. You're trying to get up high and you're just glassing those deer when they're super, super bright red. And they should still be in velvet. That can be hit or miss depending on if they start to decide to shake it off early or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be different. I mean, I do love going in November. They have, you know, the mahogany antlers from rubbing alders and stuff and the double throat patches. That's a pretty unique, cool thing about those Sitka blacktail. But I think August, we're doing it more for, you know, the experience getting out there and the nice weather, hopefully, too.
Yeah. What is, I mean, obviously it can vary, but what is weather roughly up there in August?
Oh, you might get some pretty windy stuff and rainy, but other than that, you know, you're looking at, you know, day temps around the 60s and, you know, nighttime kind of dipping down maybe a few degrees. It's kind of that coastal weather. So,
yeah.
Besides the wind and then maybe rain, it's usually pretty mellow in August.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you kind of walk us back through just that process as a non-resident? Because, you know, it's pretty doable. I mean, so many guys think Alaska and they think it has to be crazy expensive and it has to be guided and all this stuff, which certainly for some species that's the case. But really a hunt like this is a lot more doable. Can you kind of just walk us through tag acquisition and things like that?
Yeah, so it's a, you know, Alaska is pretty straightforward. This year they had their price increase and pretty much everything for a non-resident doubled. But other than that, yeah, you just go online and you make a profile and you get a license. And I think even with the price increase, two deer tags and a license, you're looking about $700. And, you know, compare that to other states, you know, it's still cheaper. And yeah, and then the logistics is the big thing. I mean, everything Alaska, like you take Alaska and, you know, you put it over the United States and how much, you know, it covers like 2/3 of the continental 48. And we actually in Alaska, I think, have 3 highways. I might be saying this wrong, but like, you know, you try to put that in perspective how few roads there are across the entire state. So that's the big thing is logistics, just getting up there from the states and then getting out to where you want to go hunt. Of course, with gear, you know, an August hunt is pretty much, yeah, I'm going to treat it like I would hunting here in the States for the most part. I think I was kind of throwing around the idea going like, you know, trying to get ultralight and go the floorless and all that. But I think just because of the fact that, you know, we might still get some of those pretty good systems with lots of rain, I ended up going with my Hillenberg Enan and I'll have that. At least I'll have that as a shell. I'm still not quite sure what I'm going to do, if I'm just going to run the shell and then have kind of like a bivy, you know, that Enlighten equipment bivy inside there, or if I'll actually run their, you know, their liner inside.
Will you be backpacking on there, like actually hiking up and down, camping up on top, or you set up a base camp and hunt from there?
We'll have, if you want to call it base camp, our base camp's going to be kind of like a dry bag with extra food and a few other little things. And then, yeah, we're just going to head out from there.
Okay.
You don't have to get, I mean, you're trying to get that high alpine, you know, you're trying to get up high where the deer are just trying to get away from the bugs and everything. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, you just kind of cruise the ridge tops until you find a little spot that you want to hunt.
How much elevation are you talking?
Oh, without giving away. Luckily, with where we're going pretty far south. So I think the biggest climb we're going to have is 2,000 feet.
Okay. So it's still big, steep country.
Yeah, because you're going from zero, right? So,
right.
Most of the stuff on Kodiak, I don't think there's much over 3,500 feet. But, yeah, it's straight up and down, you know, mainland. Mm. Kodiak. But yeah, that's pretty much it. We just making sure that we're getting the float plane lined out and between the three of us and plane tickets up there, I think we're under $2,500. So
yeah, it seems like the local logistics are where a lot of guys trip up. Just not like it's a big jump, I think, to guys who are inexperienced with a trip like this to go, all right, like I trust the commercial airline or whatever to get me into Juneau or what have you, wherever they're going. But those local logistics of like a float plane or guys who, you know, charter a boat for something like that. And then trusting like, man, that's such a big like commitment to go all the way up there and spend all kinds of money. How do you suggest guys vet kind of those local logistics, local services company, or maybe if they're going with a guide, vet that? Is it really just reaching out for recommendations and referrals?
I'm kind of a risk taker when it comes to that stuff. My sheep hunt, I flew with a guy that had just moved up from Alabama. He wanted to start flying in Alaska, had his pilot license for, I think, a couple years. He's a pretty new pilot, and he was an electrician before that, so we kind of had that in common. And anyway, long story short, nowadays I just go with pretty reputable, you know, whoever's around that area that's flying. For the most part, they have their core, you know, groups of pilots that, you know, that work that certain area. So Kodiak will have maybe, you know, three different groups that are pretty big, and they're all going to be squared away. There's some, like to me, I really like the Island Air Service who we're flying with, just because I have experience with them, and you know, they're awesome guys. So yeah, I think just reaching out to people that have hunted it before, and maybe, you know, talking to them about their experiences and who they flew with, and maybe just, you know, watching some videos too.
Yeah. Or maybe not watching videos if it's going to be stories of, yeah, misadventures. Get some guys getting scared to death of doing it. I've seen like some of those landings or some of those rough rides. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah. That's what, I don't know. I kind of like that stuff. It's part of the adventure.
Yeah.
And I know last year when we were doing the death hike, flying in, like before I was looking at videos of flying into that airstrip we flew into, just like, kind of geeking out on it. I like that part about it. So it's like you're kicking off to, you know, a whole new journey, and you know, that's the starting point.
What do you feel like heading into this year, hunting, whether it's Kodiak or some of your other tags, which we can talk about here in a bit with Nevada, things like that. What are some things that you're focusing on or still feel like you are trying to piece together or learn or just gain more experience in?
I think the planning side, I'm always, up until the last couple of years, I've had a pretty bad job anyway at doing any kind of planning. I just would fly by the seat of my pants and go, okay, this looks cool, I'm hiking in here, I'm doing whatever. And same thing with my doll sheep hunt in Alaska. It was like, well, I picked an airstrip and, you know, found a pilot that had never, you know, I was literally his second sheep hunter. I was the first sheep hunter he ever had that, you know, killed a sheep. And, anyway, you know, so I before I used to just really not plan things out very well, and that also led to some other, you know, the Kodiak story of having the Coast Guard scrambled. So I think the last couple of years I've really been focusing on trying to, you know, call people, figure the area out, try to spend some time there before if I can, and just overall plan better, because it just makes the whole experience a whole lot better when I've done my side and the homework before.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm such a planner. I'm like the opposite, but you know, I can see how it, you know, you can't always plan for everything and plans always go wrong, right? But it's good to have a plan. For me, it's like when I do have a plan, I'm then free just to like focus on the hunting, for example, versus when I go into things without a plan, I'm consumed or worried about those logistics going wrong. And so for me, it's just a matter of trying to take care of everything on the front end that I can, so that when it's time to go, I'm not worried about that stuff as much. You know, I'm just free mentally and everything else, just to put my energy into actually doing the hunting.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's cool. So in addition to Kodiak, headed to Nevada, a place you've never hunted before, I'm just curious your overall approach on that. I mean, you've hunted Alaska, you've hunted New Mexico, you've hunted Idaho, you've been in Wyoming, right? Like, now you're headed to Nevada, a whole new place. How do you approach that? Like, what are some of the first things that you're looking at when you find out you have the tag?
Probably this year for me, the first thing I was doing is, you know, picking out the big tracts of land, figuring out, you know, big chunks of public land, and going back to that planning thing, taking a little bit different approach, maybe not just focusing so much on those big tracts of land, but those tracts of land that, you know, they're near some really good ranches or farmland or something that are hard to get to. You know, you still have to work to get to. They're kind of off the beaten path. And so those are some things I've been looking at a lot more. And, you know, I think New Mexico, I put that to use pretty good down there, where I had to actually hike around private land to go hunting. So I think I'm going to use that tactic a little bit more than I originally thought this year. Going into this hunt, you know, there's a big tract of wilderness there. And I think it's nowadays, it's just, it attracts so many people that it makes it tough to just commit your whole hunt to that. So I think this year, one big thing for me is having, you know, having that plan where I will go into that, you know, wilderness area, but I also have a backup plan where, you know, if I'm not seeing something and maybe here in the next couple weeks, I might actually meet up with it's kind of like one of those scout for you services, but, he won't be doing the scouting. He'll just, take me out for a day. I pay him to take me out for a day and at least show me the country before. And I think that's something that I actually might implement this year, just as kind of try it out. You know, I feel like I burn quite a bit of valuable time on the beginning of a hunt, learning the country and learning access points into different areas. And, if I can do that a weekend before, that'll definitely be worth it. So that's kind of one of the new tactics I think, you know, I'm going to try this year.
I'm curious, just, and this is kind of coming from a personal spot for me, is we're headed to an area that we're familiar with elk hunting this year, but at the same time, we're reevaluating like plan B and C for the area. And so we're, you know, we're doing scouting from far and looking at Google Earth and things like that. And, you know, one of the question marks that I always have when doing that is, you know, kind of what you mentioned a little bit about access, Tyler. And so it's one thing to see roads, you know, on Google Earth, or even see roads on a topo. But how do you guys, any tricks or stories about really verifying that you actually can access these places, or checking for status of roads, you know, when you're going to a new state or new area?
Kind of going back to my New Mexico experience there, I think the biggest thing for me is, you know, finding those little, I totally feel like I'm going to give away way too much information, but finding those little, like calling the state and there might be an easement or something that is not real common knowledge. And there might be just a little access point or a little trail that there is a little easement on. And each state, you know, if it's a state-controlled chunk of land or whatever, they'll have, you know, an office that, you know, deals with that easement and can give you a little bit better information on it. And there are some stuff in New Mexico that just flies under the radar, that it's insane that, you know, you can access some awesome country and you you go right through private land. So, yeah, I mean, finding those little things. But as far as the Google Earth stuff, I haven't had any real, like, you know, I kind of look at stuff on Google Earth, but I don't put a lot of effort into spending too much time on Google Earth. So it's hard for me to have any stories on that too much.
Without getting into Google Earth much, when you're headed to a new state, like you are with Nevada, are you just more so going on, like, other recommendations that you have, or how are we actually dissecting, you know, you have this unit or this region that your tag's good, where the heck are you dropping the pin in the map, you know?
Yeah, so that's just it. I love to network, you know. Same thing down in New Mexico. I met a guy down there and he kind of gave me some of those little tidbits of information that just opened the keys to the, you know, most awesome country I could ever, you know, hunted on kind of a tag that you could draw every year there. So yeah, it's kind of, for me, it's more networking than anything. And, you know, just talking to guys that have been in that country and their experiences, and maybe not, like, you know, I don't ever want to hunt the exact same place someone hunted, but if I can get kind of a start, or, you know, where big bucks or big bulls tend to live, I mean, they live in those areas because they like it and they want to come back to it. And, you know, and it's definitely, it's good knowledge to have. So it's a good starting point anyway.
So Tyler, besides the planning stuff that you said you're working on, once you get in there, once you're packed in, once you're actually hunting, what do you feel like is an area that you need to focus on, maybe grow in, or lessons that you're still learning in terms of tactics, or, you know, things related to the specific action of hunting?
Actually, this one's a pretty good one. I read an article on it quite a few years back. It's like the three P's. I forget what it was called, but it was like practice, persistence, and patience, I think it was. So definitely the last one for me. I get the other two right out the gate. You know, I practice a ton and I'm pretty persistent. But patience, I am terrible at being patient. And I learned some pretty hard lessons in Wyoming this year, or last year. I stalked in on a buck, and the stalk was perfect. I mean, the thermals and the wind couldn't have been more steady, just blowing right up the hill. It just, everything like a mule deer hunter's dream. And I came in on top of him, and just everything went right. And I got to within 30 yards, and I knew he was in there because I'd seen him at like 90, and knew he was bedded in there. And then from there, I had pretty open, like I could have seen if he left. And I got all the way to 30 yards and sat down. I was like, the wind's perfect. He's just chilling. There's a couple does up the hill. They're just kind of chilling, looking at me, but they don't care. You know, nothing's going to happen with them. They're just, you know, doing their thing. They're far enough away, it wouldn't matter. And I sat there for maybe 45 minutes. I don't know. It felt like forever. It was getting hot. I mean, I had water with me. I didn't really have an excuse, but, and I wanted to see. I wanted to see if it was there, you know, that little thing, whatever, you know, makes a person make that decision. But anyway, I kind of started creeping in a little bit closer. And I was trying out those Rimrock stalkers that Travis had. And I'm like, man, I'm like a ninja with these things. I can get as close as I want. And I got pretty close. I got within 8 yards of the buck before he, when he blew out, though, he didn't even think about stopping. And I mean, it was a nice buck. I was super frustrated. It was actually my last day in there. So I was, you know, after that was pretty much it. And I was leaving when I ended up getting kind of another opportunity and shot the buck I did. But yeah, so that's going to be my big thing I work on this year, is just chilling, like not.
So when you got to 8 yards, did you know he was there, or were you just?
I hadn't seen him blow out, so I wasn't really like, I knew he was there, but it was just that little, like, I don't know, thing in my head. I wanted to get closer and see if he's still there, even though I knew, yeah. I couldn't see him. So, and I think because I couldn't see him, and that brush was just the way it was. It was thick enough, and he was bedded. You know how they get in that buck brush? They just kind of, you know, they barrel down in there, and his bed was one of those, like, you know, he owned that mound, and it was probably one of the best beds, and literally I could stand up in it, and the buck brush was still taller than me once I got over there. But yeah, he just had a nice little spot he could just disappear in.
Yeah, that's how I've been there before. I remember Tyler Crockett and I was just filming for him. This was a few years back, and we had the same, like, we saw a buck from across the canyon, you know, like a mile and a half away. And basically the second we dropped over the backside of the ridge and never saw him again, and like got all the way into position, and the way the tree was, there's big old cut into the tree below it, and he was bedded in that. And we sat there for like 3 hours, I think, not having any clue if that buck was still there. That's the most painful 3 hours of your life. It's like, you know, you have to stay there and you got to remain patient. That's so stinking tough to do. Something I definitely couldn't have done when I was, like, you know, in my early 20s or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much patience has come up as a theme in so many shows, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's something that everybody's struggling with, for sure.
Yeah.
Especially muley guys. I mean, it's kind of different if you're, like, out, you know, chasing elk, and obviously patience can pay off, but clearly when you're talking about spot and stalk and chasing muleys, I mean, patience has to be the name of the game.
Yeah, and I think you just have to mess up a certain amount of times. Like, that's just part of it, too.
Learn the hard way.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious. I want to hear about the rest of that hunt, Tyler. You mentioned it was your last day, right? And then this one blew up, but then you ended up being able to tag out. How did that go down?
So, yeah, I was just... I walked out of that basin. I was down in this pretty good-sized basin, and after that, I, you know, walked out with my head down and just, you know, grumbly and thinking, you know, I'm going to have to come back with a rifle, and I got all this other stuff going on, and, you know, and I got up to a point where two big trails up there meet, and Steve will kind of know what I'm talking about, and there was just a buck just bedded in an opportunity spot, and so, I mean, the stalk was like 15, 20 minutes tops, I don't know, time flies, but, you know, I hurried up, snuck in on him, and shot him, and, you know, it was just crazy how, like, I mean, if I would have just literally just been leaving, like, straight up, don't care, I'm out of here, then, yeah, I wouldn't have had the opportunity of the buck. It was definitely one of those, I was still in it, like, I didn't want to quit, and, you know, I didn't want to just give up, so I was looking for any little opportunity and just happened to catch that buck, and, I mean, you couldn't hardly see much of him when I was, you know, getting out of there, but, yeah, it's just pretty wild how it all worked out. So it was actually a buck I had a stalk on early in the hunt and I had a shot at. So yeah, it was just, you know, a bunch of learning experiences.
Yeah. Came back around. Man, it's a good reminder to hear, especially this time of year. You know, I can guarantee you that out of the, you know, hundreds and thousands of guys listening to this episode, that if everybody did that and just stayed in the game, even when they felt like giving up, I guarantee you that somebody, probably multiple guys listening to this, will be able to connect just because they stay in it until it's truly, truly over, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a good friend I used to hunt occasionally with, Mike. I learned that lesson from him pretty early on, man. He would, like, whenever I got to, like, you know, the furthest point from the truck, and I'm like, the hunt's over, I just put my head down and hike out, and I'd be with him, and or he'd tell me stories. I mean, just kill more animals hiking out than anything, you know, just staying focused and staying in it and remaining patient. It's all so critical.
Definitely.
Awesome. I think that's a good way to cap it there with that, man. And just, that's a lesson that we can all learn and probably relearn a few times.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll all relearn it this year.
Yeah. Tyler, how can listeners kind of stay up to date? Sounds like you have awesome hunts coming this fall and would love to see how that pans for you. You want to point them to social media or any other places they can connect with you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm pretty terrible at social media, but I think about the only thing I'm active on now is Instagram. So that's just Tyler_Boschma.
Sweet, man. And we'll probably be sharing some of the successes this fall that you're packing out in your XO for sure.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get some more cool shots and get Nick out there filming them.
Yeah. Is he filming just Kodiak for you?
Yeah, he's going to, well, with not nearly the same amount of equipment as he had last year. I don't know. He doesn't really want to talk about it much, but he doesn't have the gear he had last year. So we're basically going to be filming it kind of how Steve does with those little cameras.
Yeah.
And then he's going to do some stuff with Tyler Crockett. And then he might come out to Idaho for the elk hunt and be hunting the zone right next to me.
Yeah.
And he might come out and film a couple days, but yeah, nothing too crazy anyway.
Yeah. Sweet, man. If nothing else, it's cool just to get those memories on film.
Yeah. Did you see he did the rifle hunt in Idaho? Did you see that one at all?
Yeah, I did.
I did. Yeah. He was the one that did that.
Oh yeah. That was good, man.
Yeah. He can, I mean, for what we had, it was literally like a half day hunt. So, I mean, he didn't have much footage, but it worked out pretty good.
Yeah, if listeners want to check that out, where's that? How can they find that? Is that on YouTube? Any specific way to search for that?
So that's his Rookie Outdoors. And I think there's some stuff that they've done with South Cox and stuff on there. But yeah, it's just, I think it's still attached to my Instagram. So if you just went to my Instagram, it's the little Vimeo link or whatever. Click on that and you can see the, it's my Idaho rifle deer hunt.
Yeah, cool. Listeners, go check that out if you're interested, for sure. I do remember watching that one. It was good. Tyler, thanks a bunch for joining us, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Thanks for coming on, bud.
Yep, we'll see you.
Well, that's a wrap. Guys, again, if you have any questions about the death hike or anything else, definitely shoot us an email to podcast@xmountaingear.com. Hope you're looking forward to the show with Joe Jacks coming later this week. It is a fantastic one. I haven't yet gone out west to hunt antelope, and this show definitely made me want to do that. We cover antelope hunting, we cover tight spot quivers, we cover a lot in this episode. Make sure that you're subscribed and get it coming later this week. Thank you guys as always for tuning in. Would love to have your review in iTunes or your feedback. Go ahead and contact us. All right, we'll talk to you soon.